Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Writer Amy Tan is our guest this afternoon. Her latest novel is dark and comic. It is a mystery. Saving Fish from Drowning is the title. The story narrated by a ghost. Her name is Bibi Chen. Prior to her death, she organized a 1,000-mile expedition from China to Burma to view 1,000 years of Buddhist art. But 2 weeks before Bibi was to lead the tour, she died. It was a violent death. Was it murder? Bibi doesn't remember. Despite Bibi's death, the expedition, following the Buddha's footsteps, goes forward. While Bibi cannot lead those on the journey in the flesh, a dozen Americans, she is with them as they encounter Burma. Amy Tan is the author now of 8 books, including the novels The Bone Setter's Daughter and The Joy Luck Club. She's the author of a collection of essays, The Opposite of Fate, and 2 children's books, including Sagwa, the Chinese Siamese Cat, which was adapted as a PBS show for children and aired on our companion station, WILL-TV. Amy Tan is collaborating on an opera based on The Bone Setter's Daughter. She's also a member of the vintage garage band, The Rock Bottom Remainders. Her new book, Saving Fish from Drowning, is published by Putnam. Amy Tan, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Good to be here.
A dark comic mystery is how I described it. How do you describe Saving Fish from Drowning?
I describe it as a comic novel with serious intent. I had to use a comic, the very broad comedy of the absurd, I think, to just traipse into an area that is quite, as you put it, quite dark and difficult to think about. And that is the military regime in Burma that took over that country, renamed it Myanmar, and then has proceeded to do with what it will, without intervention or without even observers from other countries. You know, it's a very horrible situation in terms of human rights. There are terrible abuses, rape, torture, killings, but also a great deal of censorship, fear, insurgency, violence, and poverty.
Hmm. What led you to Burma? What led you to place this novel in Burma?
It started with my own invitation from people to go on an art expedition to Burma, and I thought, great, you know, beautiful country, lovely history, post-colonial romantic sense. And then I started reading about what is going on in Burma. Now, I had some sense that there had been an overthrow of the Democratic Party who was legally elected, but I had the sense that things had gotten better over the years, and I think that is the sense that most people had. And so when I discovered that there was a position by some, including the U.S. government, that you should boycott Burma, both in terms of business and visiting there, you know, I was faced with this decision, and at first it seemed very clear I shouldn't go. There was another side to it. You know, those who believe that you need to go, you need to be the observer, you need to be the watcher that will make the government behave, you need to infuse that country with dollars, much of which would go to the government, who owns many of the hotels and the airplanes, but also would go to some of the people there. I found my reason for going, and whether you call this justification or rationalization, we often have to have that when we make difficult moral decisions. I decided that since writers are forbidden to go there, journalists from other countries are forbidden to go there, and Aung San Suu Kyi had allowed that some people might go for better understanding, I felt that it was almost imperative that I go.
Yeah. Well, that gets us to the title of the book, Saving Fish from Drowning. Would you explain the title and its significance?
Well, it comes from the notion in many Buddhist countries, among Buddhists, that one should not take lives. And yet, in some of the Buddhist countries, they, out of necessity, they do have to eat because there's not enough to sustain them with the vegetation there. They hire what they might call murderers in Bhutan, say, or they hire a different ethnic group, such as the Chinese in Burma, and these are the people then who kill the animals or whatever. The fishermen there, they don't, if they happen to be Buddhists, they don't want to accrue more karmic debt, and so they change their intention. They don't fish to, you know, kill fish to sell them. They take the fish out of the water to save them from drowning. Unfortunately, the fish die, and because it's not good to waste things, they take it to market, they sell it, and the people are able to get this fish as their nutritious meal.
Hmm. And this gets us to one of the themes of this book, I think, and that is, you know, what do we believe about the world? How do we act morally within it? How do we respond to it?
Yes. My very decision about going to Burma was that dilemma. You know, what do I believe is the truth of what's going on? What is that belief based on? Where do I find truth? Certainly wouldn't look for truth from the Myanmar military regime, but, you know, what of the different people in, say, this country? Who do I believe and why? How truthful, how accurate is their presentation of what's going on? And the other, you know, then I had to make this moral decision. What if my going there was in collusion? What if in writing it helped, but what if it hurt? What if more tourists went there and the government made more money and people came to believe Burma was a wonderful place to go and they didn't care at all about what was going on there in terms of human rights? So I personally faced that decision. I think that many of us apply it to all kinds of things, and certainly the military regime there has used the excuse of getting rid of insurgents and dissidents, you know, killing them in order to have a more harmonious country. Mm. They are killing to save.
Mm. When did you go and how did you get in? Writers are not allowed.
I went in end of 2000, which is the period that this story takes place, same time around Christmas, New Year's. And I went under a visa in which I said that I was the creative consultant to children's programs. That was absolutely true. I was working on the Sagwa series. And if questioned, you know, I could say, well, this is also what I do. I you know, as soon as they found out I was there and that I actually was taking notes about Burma, I certainly would have been ejected. So I felt a little bit nervous about that because they didn't want to get the other people on the tour in trouble and have their holiday ruined. And so, you know, a lot of these decisions come with other ethical dilemmas.
In the story, there are 12 Americans who go on this expedition. A funny crew. Did you, when you were in Burma, did you feel at all like any of these 12 people you put on B.B. Chen's expedition?
Oh, I did. Many of these characters are different facets of my interest. You know, I'm fascinated with dogs, and I was found myself wishing I could have brought my dog with me because dogs are allowed in Burma. They wouldn't have been under quarantine at all. I love art. There's an art curator in this story, and Bibi, of course, was an art expert. You know, the fictional Bibi, there's no real Bibi.
Mm-hmm.
The forward to this book is fictional. There is somebody who wants to be an activist, but she doesn't know that much about what is really going on. She just has a general desire to help in some way. She's wealthy at the same time. There's a woman who's trying to find herself. She's at a crossroads in her life. She's a little bit got this stage where she's lost her passion, doesn't know that if she's followed the meaning of her life. So, you know, it goes into many different directions that have, at least in some part, touched upon things that I have thought about or have been part of my life. The woman who carries all the arsenal of things to protect herself from every calamity, that is a little bit of me, you know, things to fight germs, things in case, you know, I'm stuck in a hospital and need to have sterile needles, things to purify water, you know, which is, it's a hilarious list that this woman has, and some of it comes from my own travel kit.
Well, when we put the 12 people together with B.B. Chen, our narrator, we've got a baker's dozen. Is there, among these 13 characters, is there one that you feel most attached to, that you really enjoyed spending time with when you sat down to write?
B.B., definitely, yeah. B.B. Chen. And the reason why, in part, is that the voice of B.B. derives in large part from my mother. My mother died in 1999, and of course I was very sad and devastated to lose her, even though I knew that was going to happen because she had Alzheimer's. She had always been the source of these stories and source of inadvertent humor because of her honesty. And it was as though I heard my mother say after she died and was thinking about it, and she said, no, you know, I can still be the story. You know, I can be the narrator. I thought, oh, that's true. She can be the dead narrator. She doesn't even have to be a mother. She can just go. She's practically not a daughter to anyone. You know, set it up. She's not a mother or a daughter. She doesn't know who her mother was. So she goes on this trip with many of my mother's, what I would think my mother's opinions would be. Although my mother would not have had the notions of, say, art. She would have those notions, some of them are sort of politically incorrect, and how she views people's bathing habits, for example.
Yeah, well, B.B. Chen she's smart, she's a sharp businesswoman, she doesn't mince words, and actually all those things kind of get her in trouble. But at the outset, she ruminates on her two mothers, her birth mother and her father's wife.
Yeah.
So the mother-daughter relationship is here.
Yeah. You know, I suppose I could never get away from that. But because I feel so much of our sensibilities and our humanity derives from our families in a particular way and especially from our mothers. They are often, for daughters, they often serve as a model to either eventually be like that mother or reject that and be completely different or somewhere in between. Bibi lost her mother when she was a baby and has no idea who her mother is except by the stories told by others, including this woman who seems to always be maligning her mother but yet saying she's just like her mother. Bibi, as a result, feels that she has never learned to feel deeply. And yet she goes on this trip, and she does feel deeply about something. She feels even more deeply at the end of the trip. And I think the other people, the other characters in this story, feel more deeply about the people in Burma.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was the way I wanted it to be, that they all had their endings, some of them, you know, the quintessential ending to a story, you know, where you learn the outcome of things, and yet maybe there remains one very strong question is what happened to those people in Burma?
Yeah. Well, speaking of stories and endings, let's talk about the beginning. At the outset of the book, I feel you're winking at us. You're going to tell us a story, and some things will be true and some things may not be true. And in the outset of the book, in a note to the reader, you write, whether one believes in communication with the dead or not, readers are willing to suspend disbelief when immersed in fiction. We want to believe that the world we have entered through the portals of another's imagination indeed exists, that the narrator is or has been among us. When does the tale begin?
It is something that is interwoven into the story. The tale begins, for one thing, in some respect, with the epigraph that talks about saving fish from drowning. There's a real one that's from Camus about intentions, and then there's one that is based on that notion of saving fish from drowning. The note to the reader is cloaked in that classic form where we assume everything in the note to the reader is true. Some of the most absurd and strange parts of it actually are indeed based on fact. What's happening with the military regime, they're named Slork originally, they're using a PR firm in the U.S. to change their image, rename them with a more benevolent-sounding name, and the myth of the younger white brother, the twin deities among the Karen. So there are things in there that are true. What's not true, what's not based on, real reality, is the fact that I got this story by going to the American Society of Psychical Research one day when it was raining. I just happened to dash in, finding an archive of automatic writings, including a 900 stack of pages from dictated by a ghost in San Francisco named Bibi Chen, a name I supposedly recognized. She was a big socialite and owned this famous store, and that it concerned 12 people who disappeared in Burma, or 11 people, made headlines, international headlines on TV, newspaper magazines for weeks. Now, I expected at some point the readers would start questioning the truth of this story, because maybe they'd say, I've never heard of this story before. People in San Francisco might say, I've never heard of Bibi Chen. And I did that in part because I wanted to be able to question what is it that we know is true based on our sources. Is it simply assumed to be true because I called it a note to the reader, or that I cast it into a newspaper article form? Now, part of this equation is it wasn't really to just wink at the reader and trick them. I figured some people would figure out it was fiction, but that later on what always happens with the book is that you talk about it in real life. You have this intersection between fiction and reality, and that there would be a conversation like the one we're having, and I could talk about this issue of truth and where we find it, and often we are confused as to what is truth and what is opinion and what is simply made up.
Yeah. Well, I went online before I read the materials that came with the book from Putnam, and there is
you can find that.
There is an American Society for Psychical Research, and it goes back to the 19th century. And William James was one of the founding officers.
Yes. It's a wonderful building, too. I did go in there, and not on a rainy day. I happened to be passing. They said, what a fascinating place. Went in. The way I described it is exactly how it is. Wonderful archives. Happened to see these archives of automatic writing, and jokingly said to myself, wouldn't it be wonderful if you could just get some ghost to download a great story for you, and you just take these pages, polish it up a bit, and call it your novel? The ghost would never come after you for plagiarism, or lie, having maligned them in any way. They wouldn't sue you because they're dead, There's this humorously playing with that notion. Then I thought, this would be an interesting thing because it would allow me to set the basis for having a dead narrator who would have omniscience but also very strong opinion.
Yeah. I'm just curious, how is it that this society has existed all these years, and what are they about today?
They do, well, as their name implies, American Society for Psychical Research, which does have a counterpart in England, they do research on paranormal phenomena. So they might look at, can you transfer a thought to another person when they can't see you? And they might, present five objects that you're looking at, and you're trying to tell the person in the other room, I am looking at the apple. And then you have the person in that other room write down what comes to mind. And then they look at that, see if there's any correlation. And I didn't actually look at their results. They publish a magazine that comes up, I think, quarterly. I actually joined the society so that I could have access to their archives. So now I get this journal. And I have to admit, I haven't really read the journal, but I think they concern these research findings.
Yeah. Well, online you can go and you can click on to an article or two there that they make available, and the titles of the articles were somewhat daunting.
There is a story about a woman named Pearl Curran in the 1920s and 30s, a woman who had no education, formal education, beyond the age of 14, who received, supposedly, whole novels dictated by a ghost named Patience Worth, who lived, supposedly, in the 16th century or 17th century, but wrote about times, medieval times. And supposedly, there are no anachronisms beyond the 16th, 17th century, whenever this writer was supposed to have lived. No anachronisms. Peculiar language, which might have been, indeed, a fusion between, you know, language in the 1600s and somebody trying to imitate language from the Middle Ages.
Mm. Boy, how do you sort through this? We're back to the same question. How do you sort through what's
there? How do you
know
what's true?
Yeah.
I know. Well, it's a wonderful question to ask oneself and to look at everything one day, you know, look at everything on the news and say, okay, what is truth based on facts? What is opinion? What is actually mistakes in truth? I might be telling you things that are, you know, I've recalled it wrong. And the people, because I'm talking on the radio, might assume that everything I say is true. What are things, you know, that we read and hear and see in all kinds of places based on our notions of what is the truth?
Yeah, and there's so much information out there. It's a tall order.
Well, you know, there's a huge difference between radio stations, the kind of show you have and the kind of show that, say, more for, you know, kind of fun interaction, loud shouting that goes on to wake people up in the morning. I've been on shows like that. You know, different things, and they might say, sort of comment on the same things that are going on today in the world, and you'll get a different perspective. And maybe multiple perspectives like that are important to have.
Yeah. Well, let me try my best impersonation of another kind of show. Issue, Amy Tan, do you believe in ghosts?
You know, that question relates to, for me, to do I believe in an afterlife, some sort of existence beyond our current one that we that is perceivable by our senses. I would like to believe that something goes on, some form of consciousness, some form of spirit beyond this life. And I figure that it does affect what I do in life now, but for the better. And that if I die and I'm wrong, I'm obviously not going to be disappointed because there will be no consciousness to be disappointed. If I believe that there's nothing, and I still might go about and lead my life constructively and with that sense in mind that there's only a certain amount of time left to do things, and then if I die and there's nothing, I'm not going to feel that I was justified because I won't have any consciousness to prove it, but I might be surprised. I think it doesn't hurt. The reason why I believe in something, I have had things I can't explain through ordinary means. I have had, it seems like, help. I've had feelings of my mother, seeing my mother before me, and feeling at the point when a real person would have touched me, this shock of intense feeling of love, peace, and hope that made made me realize that all things, all these things were the same thing. I never would have had that realization any other way, but it was. Mm-hmm. And I've never had a feeling that intense. Some people could say it was grief or delusion or schizophrenia or seizure or, you know, all kinds of reasons why you could, that you could ascribe to that experience. But I like to believe that it was an existence of some kind, a consciousness of some kind that went beyond death.
Hmm.
Even if it was imagination, it's wonderful to believe that.
Hmm. Well, even if you, in your heart of hearts, don't think it possible, there's such an intensity of the feeling, especially after the death of someone you love. There might be other things that spark a memory later, but
yeah.
All that intensity, you can't, you know, that person is just with you.
Yes, and, you know, it may be wishful thinking. Some people do believe the person is there. They're not going to go to wherever they go afterward until things are a little more settled. I have talked about this, actually, in that memoir, Essays of My Writing Life, Opposite of Fate. And there is something about a friend of mine who was murdered and what happened afterward and the very peculiar things of being told, and at least it seemed I was being told by him, what was important, what was going to happen, and indeed those things happened very, very specifically, following certain advice that he said would lead to a result, and it was exactly right. How do you explain things like that? I don't know. Is it I distorted my memory of what happened later on? Yeah, you know, I can very easily take the rational point of view and look at it that way. I think it's important to ask the question, what do you believe about existence beyond this life after death? Because it might influence what we think about qualities of, say, hope or, you know, the development of consciousness of one's heart, to one's perceptions of things, of knowledge. It's then, you know, reflects on what we believe. That belief, for example, intersects with how people view certain tragedies in life. And in China, you know, I heard my brother-in-law say, well, you know, they execute people. I said, what if they executed somebody who was innocent? And he said, well, this is very unfortunate, but he will have a better next life. I thought, it's an interesting way of, you know, justifying a possible mistake that has severe moral consequences.
Mm.
If you believe in reincarnation, does that ease some things that happen, some tragedies that happen?
Mm. There is a new book out written by a journalist, and we're going to have her on the program in the near future. Her name is Mary Roach, and she's written this book called Spook. And, you know, she asks a very profound question, but she handles it very humorously. And she's not a believer, but bottom line is, she says, I'd rather walk through a cemetery with someone who's a believer.
Yeah.
You know?
I love Mary Roach's writing, by the way. I read Stiff and had a fabulous time with that. And if I donate my body to science, I'm going to put down no facelifts. It's too late. Don't experiment on new techniques, you know, with me. I really want to read this book. I just saw her yesterday and we were talking about this. And that... One thing I remember is that, reading somewhere, is that the true word skeptic is not the skeptical we often think of, which is to poo-poo something and say that can't possibly be true. I'm very skeptical of that. Skeptic in the old sense was meaning, sort of had a more open-minded meaning, that you looked at all the possibilities and then sort of tried to find evidence for one or the other. And I like that notion better of skepticism, you all possibilities are taken into account. No assumptions. Oftentimes, research starts off with an assumption that needs to be proved, and you can find evidence one way or the other to support that. And I just know that in terms of other medical information that did not serve me well. Mm-hmm. So it's a good notion to play with, the notion of skepticism and what do we really believe, especially in things that seem so far out as to what Mary Roach is talking about in Spooked.
Mm. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon in this portion of the program, writer Amy Tan. Her latest book, her latest novel, is Saving Fish from Drowning. It's published by Putnam. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. I want to go back just quickly here to the idea of Mary Roach taking up a very profound topic and dealing with it so humorously. And here in Saving Fish from Drowning, you have a comic novel with serious intent, is how you described it. How did you make that choice to take a very serious topic and look at it with these... With a humorous
broad comedy.
Bent. Yeah.
Because I was so troubled by this notion of people suffering and being helpless to help, and what should I do if there was anything that could possibly help, and wanting to explore things. Yet there were many books out there already about this very subject of calling attention to it. I hadn't read them. I didn't want to read them. They started off being horrific. They got more horrific. In the end, you're feeling helpless about how horrific it is, the complexities of it. And yet they need to be read. The information in those books needs to be read. How can you lure people actually into reading about that? Comedy has often served a subversive purpose. Comedy, laughter, is and fiction. Fiction can be very subversive in getting people to ride along with an imagination that takes them places they never would want to go. To get these people into the story, to get myself into the story, to do what storytelling is best, I had to create some tension in the way, or suspense. And I started playing with different genres. Comedy would be the one overall because often, again, to talk about really serious, ugly things and the absurdities of that, to just get people to let go of assumptions, laugh, open up their emotions, comedy would serve me well. Broad comedy, not anything too subtle. And along the way, I'd also throw in a dash of murder mystery, political thriller, travel log.
Romance.
Teenage scatological humor, the comedy of romances like Midsummer Night's Dream, folktale, myth, all of that sort of rolled into one. Just that to me was a literary exercise that was quite fun. It was with a purpose of taking the comedy. I had thought of writing a very serious novel, but I was afraid that it would start off being didactic, being polemical, that it would start off with a conclusion that I wanted to prove by bringing in the kind of fictional elements that needed to support that. I wanted it to be a surprise in which you're just simply going along and find yourself in a terrible situation.
We have a couple of listeners who would like to talk with you. Amy, let's go and talk with a listener on line 4 in Dalton, our toll-free line. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Amy Tan, I wanted to compliment you on The Bone Setter's Daughter.
Thank you.
That was so good. I really enjoyed you reading it. I'm blind, and it was really well-read And the lady that read it with you was wonderful, too.
Oh, thank you. But that was Joan Chen, the actress.
Pardon?
That was Joan Chen, the actress and director.
Oh, she was, both of you did a wonderful job on it. And, but that's all I wanted to say, but I just wanted to compliment you on the book.
Oh, thank you. You know, I know that that book was actually out in Braille form, and I was really honored that it was like that. And I know that, you know, I saw a Braille book, and it's huge, you know, by the time it's there. But I also knew that it would reach many people through audio, and then it ended up winning an award for People Give Awards audio program for that were available to the visually impaired. Thank you for that comment.
I hope you do this one on audio.
It is. All my books actually are on audio. And so, you know, it's there. It's in a number of formats, I think.
You know what? I couldn't MP3. Find the Joy Luck Club.
It's out there.
Is it?
Definitely out there.
Okay.
I'm sure if you can't find it, you know, in your regular store, you can look on eBay. I normally wouldn't say that, but if it's not out there in print or whatever they call it,
okay,
it's out there.
Yeah, or enlist the help of a librarian.
Right. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly. That's what I shall do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Bye bye.
Bye.
And next, we talk with a listener in Bourbonnais on line one. Hi.
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 I'm sorry, just as you spoke, something went wrong with the connection. Can you hear me?
We can hear you, yes.
Okay. My question derives from your remarks about subversiveness, and I suspect it will take this discussion into a whole new level of profundity. How was your writing of this book affected by your membership in the Rock Bottom Remainders?
You know, there are a lot of moral decisions there as well. You know, there again, it's that notion of using sort of laughing about things and getting people engaged. We, our excuse, our rationalization for doing this ridiculous thing of having middle-aged people wear tight costumes and sing ridiculous songs with very little talent in front of many different people paid good money is that those monies go to a charity called America Scores. And that's a program that benefits kids in inner city schools, kids at risk, between the ages of 8 and 12 or 13. They learn to develop individual expression literacy through poetry and then team skills through soccer, believe it or not. Very successful program that has just taken off in many parts of the country. So we're very proud to be part of that. We've raised about $1.5 million for those programs, and as well as some awareness in places as we go around, you know, calling attention to the availability of this program.
What exactly do you do in the band?
You don't want to know.
Oh, I really do.
I play the dominatrix, actually. They call it the rhythm dominatrix. And
just as I might have suspected.
Yeah, Scott Turow gave me, Scott Turow wears a wig and sings Talking Head songs, gave me a cat of nine tails as well. And the end of my signature song, Boots, you know, I indicate that the boys have not been quite good about meeting their publishing deadlines or whatever, and so they dutifully turn around, and I whip them. Sometimes they accidentally actually hit them, and they jump, but people somehow, it doesn't matter how horribly I sing, when I do that, they just think I'm terrific.
So dreams do come true.
Yeah. Actually, that was never my dream. That's so, you know, not me. But that's something you have to do to have a lot of fun and just loosen up. It was the idea of the other members of the band, actually. I was horrified when they first mentioned that, you know, Boots, that song, that particular song. I wanted to sing pretty songs. Which I don't have the voice to do. If you don't have a very good voice, singing voice, you really should sing songs with a lot of attitude, comedic songs, really ham it up.
And there are, on the discs that we have here at the station, the two CD set, Stranger Than Fiction.
Oh, no.
It's, yeah. Yeah, I got it.
Favors I'll do you, please. Don't listen to that.
Well, it's for a good cause, and it's all in great fun. And you must have a great time when you get together.
Oh, we all love each other, and that's why we also do it. You know, it's totally self-indulgent because we want to get together and have fun. And Dave Barry is even more hilarious in person, if you can believe that. Stephen King is very funny and the sweetest person. Very intelligent. And all these people. Kathy Kamen Goldmark was the one who founded the band. And pick what you would think would be the most incompatible set of writers, but it all worked. She picked people who didn't have a big ego about themselves in terms of music and other things, and came together simply for the sake of having fun.
Mm.
And Kathy now is an author herself. Yeah, it was an all-author band except for Kathy, and now she's an author too. She wrote a book called "And My Shoes Keep Walking Back to You." Great book.
Yeah. Before I think when we wrap up, I'll play just a little bit of Rainy Day Bookstores because I think that's a fun tune, and we'll let people go out and look for Stranger Than Fiction so they can hear you do These Boots Are Made for Walking. But anyway, I want to, on another musical front, tell us what's up with the opera, The Bonesetter's Daughter.
Well, I am writing libretto with another librettist, with the composer Stuart Wallace, who's done a number of operas, including Harvey Milk. And he came to me, Stuart, because he had done the prologue for my birthday just as a gift, and then he couldn't get it out of his mind. So we're going to be doing this opera, premiering end of 2007 or beginning of 2008, and then doing the reverse immigration, I guess. We're going to take it to China, where the heart of the story originated, and so we're going to be able to perform it in China. I am learning a lot about libretto. I was a failed piano student for 15 years, classical piano, and go to the symphony a lot. So I love how this all gets together, this collaborative creative process. Opera, writing opera libretto is not as difficult or mysterious as I thought. I, for one thing, people ask me questions that I probably had myself, like, do you have to write it in Italian? Or do you have to match the length of the stanzas according to the music? How does that work? That there's some particular form you have to follow. Stuart Wallace, the composer, actually said, it's very good that I know very little about how opera is made, because by casting away these assumptions, I can really do something fresh. I will end up writing these lines that I, capture the sense of what these characters might say, and Stuart would just pick those lines out verbatim and or arrange them and say, this is libretto. So it's been fun. You have to drive the story through and make it absolutely crystal clear. If words can't be so obtuse that people can't figure out what you're saying. There's a lot of comedic elements to it, a lot of harmonies, a lot of solo arias, and it has to be hugely dramatic and emotional. Opera is over the top.
Mm-hmm.
It is the highest form of, combining music, my opinion, combining music and the written language, drama, theater, live performance, all of that. It's fantastic fun. Part of this also is to make it relevant to the next generation. It's an art that is in jeopardy if you don't keep it relevant and find the listeners, ongoing listeners. And we'll be taking it to colleges and workshopping it so they have the experience of participating in the collaborative process of creating a work of art and applying it, the creative process, to their own discipline, outside of the traditional disciplines you would think. So history, structural engineering, architecture, things like that.
Wow. Well, I hope we'll see you here at the University of Illinois.
Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah. Well, from over the top in an artful direction to now over the top in a silly, silly a kind of venue. Let me thank you first very much, Amy Tan, for talking with me this afternoon and our listeners. And again, your latest book is Saving Fish from Drowning, published by Putnam. And let's go out here with Rainy Day Bookstores. I hope you're having a great tour.
Thank you.
Stone you just like they said they would. They'll stone you when you try to go.
The Rock Bottom Remainders, proceeds from the sale of the group's CD, Stranger Than Fiction, are donated to the Penn Writers Fund and other charities. The CD is available on the label Don't Quit Your Day Job Records. And the interview with Amy Tan from 1 month ago, November 1st of 2005. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Let's find out what happened now today on the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason. Well, tell you what, why don't I go ahead and give you the settlement prices from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and then we'll turn our attention to the Chicago Board of Trade. It was a higher day today on the Merc. January feeder cattle, 117.90, the high, 116.47.5, the low, the settlement, 117.65, that up 75. March, 116.10, the high, 114.65, the low. The settlement, 115.87.5, that up 55. April feeder cattle, 114.37.5, the high, 112.95, the low. 114.37.5, the settlement, that up 65. December live cattle, 94.45, the high, 93.40, the low. 94.37.5, the settlement, that up 92.5. February live cattle, 96.95, the high, 95.67.5, the low. The settlement, 96.90, that up 117.5. December lean hogs, the high today, 63.40, the low, 62.35, finishing at 63.35, that up 85. February lean hog, 68 even, the high, 67.25, the low. The settlement, 67.95, up 60. April lean hog, 70.20, the high, 69.60, the low, 70.15, the settlement, that up 37.5. And May lean hogs also finished up 37.5 today. The high was 71 even, the low 70.30, the settlement 70.97.5 again, that up 37.5. And February bellies 89.22.5, the high 88.10, the low, the settlement 89.15, that up 90. Here now with the settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade, Todd Gleason.
Thanks very much, Celeste. From the Board of Trade this afternoon, futures in the wheat pit finished like this, 306.75, the high for the day, the low at 301. Settlement price at 305.5. They were a penny and a half higher. The March contract, 323.5, the high, the low at 317. Settled at $3.22. They were up 1.25 for the day. May futures at 332.75, high, low at 326.75. Settlement price are at 331.5. And they finished 2 higher. July contract at 341.5, high, low at 335.25. Settlement price 340, up a penny and a quarter. And September wheat futures finished 349 on the high, the low at 344. September 2006 contract settled at $3.48 a bushel. It was up a penny and a half. From the corn pit nearby, December contract now, 189.5 the high, the low at 186.5, settlement price at 189.25, and that finished a penny and 3/4 higher for the day. The March futures, 204 the high, the low at $2.5, settlement price 203.75, and it was up 2. May futures, 212.5 the high, the low at 209.25. Settlement price 212.25, up 2.25. July contract in the corn pit, $2.20.5, the high, the low at 17.5, and a settlement price at 220.25. They were up 2.25 for the day. September futures, 228.75. The high, the low at 226.75. Settlement price at 228.5. A penny and 3/4 higher. And December corn for next year, 239.75. The high, the low at 37.5. And a settlement price up on that high at $2.39.5 a bushel for the December 2006 contract in the corn pit, up a penny and 3/4. December oats now up 15 cents today. Had a high of $2, a low at 186.75, settled up on the high, 15 higher for $2 settlement price for the December oats. March contract up 4.5 cents, 186 the high, the low at 180, settlement price at 185.75. Soy complex now, January soybeans, 564 the high, low at $5.54, settled 559.75. They were penny and 3/4 higher. The March at 571.25 the high, the low at 562.5, settled at 568, up 1.75. May contract at 576 high, low at 568, settlement price at 573.25. They were two higher for the day. In July soybeans, 581.5 the high, the low at 573, settled at 578.25. They were up 1.75. August contract now 584 the high, the low at 577, settlement price at $5.80.5, up a penny and a half. And September futures were up 2 today, settled at 582, the high at 84, the low at 80 even. And next year's November contract in the bean pit, $5.91 the high, the low at 583.5, settlement price at 587, up a half cent. December bean meal, 172.30, up 50 for the day, the high at 174, the low at 171.50. January contract up 40 at 172.50. December bean oil, 21.12 the high, the low at 20.84, settlement price for the oil at 21.04, down 1 for the day, and the January futures were down 2 cents at 21.27. And that's a look at the numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
And on Wall Street, the Dow is up 108 points at 10,914, the NASDAQ 33 higher at 2266, and the S&P 500 is up 15 points at 1265. It's 1.5 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: First Federal Savings Bank, Champaign and Urbana; Swires Land and Management Company, Danville; Michael W. Walker Consulting, Urbana; and Weiskamp Screen Printing, Champaign. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
Ed Kieser's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon: in western Illinois, partly to mostly sunny, and eastern Illinois, cloudy with some lingering flurries early. In Indiana this afternoon, cloudy with periods of light snow mixed with rain in the far south. Highs this afternoon ranging from 25 in far northwestern Illinois to 43 in the far south. Tonight, in northern and east central Indiana, cloudy with some light snow. Elsewhere, partly to mostly cloudy. Lows ranging from 5 in northwestern Illinois to 23 in southeastern Indiana. Tomorrow, a mix of clouds and sun. Highs ranging from 22 in northwestern Illinois to 42 in the far south. In Champaign-Urbana this afternoon, cloudy and windy with a few flurries possible early. The high 33, winds northwesterly at 15 to 25.